What was your
Kate Webster.
Kate Webster.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the, it's in the mausoleum of my dead code.
Enemies, this is Bad Voltage, Series 2, Episode 54.
Do we have enemies?
He says, updating the document. I heard an interesting thing. The reason I did that is because someone says, ladies and gentlemen, is a very old-fashioned way to do things. You say friends and enemies instead. And I thought, that's actually quite cool. I'm going to steal that for Bad Voltage. So
I like that a lot because I did. I think it was like a talk or something a little while ago, and I said, ladies and gentlemen. I thought, particularly in this the current era of, you know, of trans awareness and gender fluidity,
it feels a very clunky, old-fashioned, reactionary thing to say, doesn't it? I really like the friends and enemies thing.
It's also a little bit kind of, you know, dashing, you know, dashing kind of. I don't know. There's something. Old-fashioned in a nice way about friends and enemies. Anyway, enough of that. But so we've got a lot of news to get to. Well, actually, we don't have a lot of news to get to, but we've got meaty news to get through with lots of discussion. And I'm excited about the show because there's some really interesting things for us to dig into. What are we going to do first? Do you want to kick us off, Mr. Langridge?
Okay, well, one thing that was a big piece of news is GitHub now have a sponsorship program. GitHub Sponsors, yes. It's called. And it's quite interesting. There's a couple of different angles to it. The first one is you now have the ability to just put a funding button on any GitHub repository. And one of the nice things about that is you can either point it at GitHub's own GitHub Sponsors program, or you can point it at a bunch of other stuff, Open Collective, a couple of other things. Patreon, yep. You can just point it at an arbitrary URL. So I've pointed all mine at my paypal.me URL.
Yeah.
Well, when I say all of them, I mean the two repositories I have that people actually use. But I thought that was quite nice. It's very easy to do. Just drop a funding.yaml file into your repository. Done. Bosh. Everyone's a winner. I have what you might call philosophical reservations about the concept, but I like the implementation.
What are your reservations?
Well, hang on. Jeremy looked like he was going to say something.
I was going to say, here's where I'm going to jump in, because I don't like the implementation, and this is an interesting topic for a bunch of different reasons. I should note here that Stuart and I have talked about this before, and the reason we didn't have a show last show is because my recording went suddenly wobbly in Audacity and was not, even our very mediocre audio engineer could not fix it. So,
hang on, why am I getting crap for your inability to record audio correctly?
So for those of you who listened to the show before last, where my audio went wobbly for like a couple of seconds, it did that for like 20 minutes. So we just didn't release the show, but Ak and I did talk about this topic a little bit. Jana was not available for the show, so wasn't on it. So we're kind of rehashing this for us, but it's new to Jana and new to you, or at least our take on it is. So just wanted to get in my Audacity troubles there. So the reason I didn't like this, and I went into it in depth in the last show, and I probably am not going to be as articulate for whatever reason, I'm guessing, this time. But I actually really don't like their implementation and think that they squandered an awesome opportunity. And the reason for that is they chose GitHub sponsorships, which I think is the perfect name, and then they made it GitHub donations, which is not how I think this should be approached. And I think that funding open source projects is something that all three of us are passionate about in maybe slightly different ways, but genuinely important to all three of us. So this is definitely something I want to see succeed, and I very much hope this is their first iteration of it. But the reason that I don't like it, and the reason that this is more a donation system to me, more akin to Patreon than I would have liked to see it be, is that it's a nice starter for a person giving another person coffee money, right? But if you want to drive serious money and make open source sustainable, companies, I think, have to be involved and should be involved, right? Because they're profiting off of open source and should help sustainably make open source a thing. So very few companies have a large donation budget. All of them have a marketing budget. Some of them have massive marketing budgets. So a true sponsorship system where companies could sponsor and they could have meaningful tiers and a whole, you know, a system around it, I think would be awesome. And GitHub is the perfect company to do this because many large organizations already have, GitHub already has their billing information. So that is one, there's no compliance component, there's no legal component, there's no getting another contract approved component. GitHub already has all that for many large organizations, especially ones that are involved with open source. So them handling the sponsorship piece, there's very little friction. But instead of doing that, they made it, you have to be a person and you have to give it to a person. Where in many cases, I know I use an open source project, but I'm not maybe day-to-day involved enough to know who the correct person is. I want to support the project. I don't want to support one random specific person in that project. So by not allowing you to support projects and tying it to people, it makes it very difficult to use it in that regard. And then by making it really not a true sponsorship system, I think they're really missing out an opportunity to dig into companies' marketing budgets.
And that is largely my philosophical issue that I mentioned with it. That what this is doing is it's encouraging, it's incentivizing, it's promoting a model where an individual person supports an individual open source project they like out of niceness. Because they think, oh, it's important that I use that thing, here's $5. And what we should be doing, ideally, we've talked about this endlessly on the show, is building a world in which companies who are wholly and completely reliant on open source, who will just say, oh yeah, we'll just like install all these NPM modules or whatever, where those companies start giving some of the money they've got to support the open source substrate on which they wholly depend. And not only are GitHub the perfect people to do this, they might be the only people in a position to do this, and they didn't. So they are incentivizing the open source is still about individual people thing. And for sustainability, it isn't. And they really could have done more. And largely my view on this was inspired by the conversation I had with Jeremy 2 weeks ago, but
he had a slightly different opinion before last week's recording, I should say.
Oh, really? Yes. You're getting a bit of a do-over language.
I'd never let it be said that I don't listen to people's advice and take it on board. The fact that I get to drop the old advice down the memory hole and learn something new is just convenient in this case.
Also, it should be noted that about 10, 15 years ago, you did in fact say, I'm never wrong. I'm always right. I don't listen to people. Anyway,
I have in fact learned that I was wrong and have taken that advice on board.
It's like rain on your wedding day. Anyway, carry on.
It is. It's like a set of Russian dolls inside which is just more wrongness. So that's my philosophical objection. I really do feel like we need to build a world where companies are... Consider it just a normal cost of doing business that some of the huge piles of cash they've inhaled end up making its way down to the open source world they are dependent on.
And I think that's kind of the approach. Open Collective's taking that approach, right? But I think part of the problem there, once again, is a lot of people have never heard of Open Collective. So you're not only adding that billing and other friction, you're adding that, do I trust Open Collective? If you've never heard of them, right? So you've heard of GitHub. Certainly, if you're in the open source community. So I think that's why I think GitHub is uniquely positioned, because this is obviously a problem that's getting a lot more attention with Tidelift out there doing some cool stuff. And I believe GitHub sponsors actually was worked on with the Tidelift folks. You have Open Collective out there. You have Community Bridge from LF. So this is definitely a problem that is finally, I think, getting the attention and exposure that it deserves. It's just I think GitHub's uniquely positioned to, if they do it well, to really make an impact.
Like I say, they are, I think, the only people in a position to do this, because everyone else is at least partially doing it so they get paid, or they're doing it as some kind of, we want to make the open source world better and we're not going to get paid for providing this service, at which point they themselves are not sustainable and will go under in 2 years. So
I'm not sure I... I'm not sure I agree that only GitHub can do this. I think there are lots of companies that could conceivably do this. I think GitHub are in a really good position to do this because they're such an epicenter of what's going on in open source. But I share both of your views that the fact that they focused on the individual contributor donation as opposed to donating to a project, I think was a grave mistake. I think it's a mistake for a number of reasons. One reason is that any time you inject money into an open source project, unless it's handled very carefully, it can cause really deep-seated problems.
Again.
If you've got five developers contributing to a shared project and one person starts getting the cash, or starts getting more cash than the other person, then it can cause some animosity. I think it will. It's unclear how you tie the donation to what kind of work you're rewarding, right? So I can foresee, for example, individual developers getting donations for building new features that people want. But a lot of people who are out there fixing bugs, writing documentation, doing the grunt work that is involved in an open source project will probably get overlooked. And then that can annoy people and like, well, I'm back here doing a lot of this grunt work and this other person gets all, you know, a bunch of the cash.
Yeah.
And also just a lot of open source projects are just, they don't have the structure to be able to handle this kind of thing. So I think what they've done, GitHub have done a really good job with, is the implementation is simple and elegant. And the fact that they're waiving a lot of the fees is great. But my worry here, to be completely blunt, is that this is actually going to cause in some projects more problems than benefits. And I hope it doesn't. But I think it's good that GitHub is trying to solve the right kind of problem.
Yep.
And I think this is a first attempt at it. And I'm sure that they'll add.
They'll definitely iterate from here, for sure.
They'll iterate from here and they'll add the ability to sponsor to projects. But I'm surprised that they focused on the individual as opposed to the project.
Yep.
And I get why they did that, because individuals, it's easier for individuals to receive funds than it is for projects.
Yes.
Because it's a nightmare for projects to receive funds. And even then, like when I was at Canonical, we would have the Ubuntu donations fund and Canonical handled all the cash and settled it, took care of the taxes and stuff like that. And people just didn't know how to ask for money. Like it was, we had to try and give it away. Like we had to literally call people and say, do you want cash? So open source projects, even well-organized ones, are not very well set up for this. So
yes,
we're kind of blazing a trail here.
See, also Linux Fund.
Yeah, exactly. It's surprisingly difficult to give away money, I've learned.
I actually think that, and I'm, look, for full disclosure, you know, I'm doing, the Linux Foundation are one of my clients, but I actually think that what they've done with Community Bridge is a good model here, because they're really focused on the individual project and then they provide tools for the distribution of the funds within the project.
You probably want to explain what Community Bridge is.
So Community Bridge as a broad summary, is a set of tools that help people to run open source projects. So, for example, they've got one which is focused on security, being able to identify security vulnerabilities and check a tool chain. They've got one which is funding, and they're building out these different components and modules. So, you know, like you've got GitHub, which is where you can go and store your code and deal with issues, but then you've got Community Bridge is essentially a set of things that can wrap around an open source project, a lot of which the LF does for their larger projects, right? And so they built this funding piece, which is built into Community Bridge, where somebody can go and say, I want to donate this amount of money to an open source project. And then there's tools within the funding component in Community Bridge where they can say, you know, these funds will be distributed for these purposes. And just like the GitHub thing, they will cover the fees and they'll take care of all the taxes and stuff like that. So it's very similar to GitHub sponsors, I think, but it's more focused on the project. And I think it provides tools for the distribution of that money for solving the different bits of work within the project.
The one thing I really like about Community Bridge is the mentorship piece. I'm still not clear on the funding piece, and every time I try to get more information, it's been difficult because Jono and I were both at the conference where they announced it, so we were kind of beta members and things. So we had a little bit of early access to it. And I'm still not clear on enough of the details that my opinion isn't fully fleshed out. I mean, I really like what Open Collective is doing on the transparency side. I think that model is great, where you can see exactly what happened, where the money went. If you're involved with the project, you can request money from the pool and it gets approved by a group of people from the project. So in that regard, I think Open Collective is probably the best on the transparency side. I think the Tidelift model is super, super interesting to me, where for those of you not familiar with it, you're basically supporting the libraries that you use automatically through their platform. So, you know, if you're a node person like ACT, you just upload your NPM dependencies and it will automatically see who's in the system, and you can fund it by how much you use it. And I think it's a really cool model. The thing that's interesting to me about Tidelift is they are, I think, amongst all of them, have the most open source bona fides of the group. Like, I trust Havoc to get it right and do the right thing, and Louise to get it right and do the right thing. So I think the people involved alone are encouraging with Tidelift, but I think it's interesting to me. They've each gotten like one component correct. It's going to be interesting to see who gets the whole package correct, and exciting to see, hopefully, that whoever gets it correct really, really succeed and make a demonstrable difference, because obviously open source sustainability is like critically important, I think.
I agree.
In order for that to happen, in my opinion, it needs to become a standard part of using any project that you're thinking about your funding policy for it, your sponsorship.
That's why I think it has to be part of marketing budgets for enterprises and large corporations, not individual dollars from people.
Yeah,
totally. But that's why I think a third-party company isn't going to get it done, because they have to insert themselves essentially as a middleman into everyone's business process, which is hard because people just don't trust that. It looks like someone's trying to stick themselves in and then just take 10% off the top, whereas GitHub is already a middleman in everyone's process, right? We could have rooted around them, and we didn't.
I'm not sure I'd buy that, because I don't think anyone has an issue with someone providing a valuable service where you can contribute to anything, whether it's to an open source project, to another organization, whatever, and then you pay a convenience fee, if you will,
service. It has the hotel problem. Yes, I completely agree with you. If Tidelift really takes off and every company who uses open source starts tithing a small amount of money to their dependencies via Tidelift, the next thing that happens is someone else goes, well, I'm going to set up TideliftRival.com. because I'd like to see a piece of that sweet moolah, at which point there are 25 companies do it, and suddenly it's not easy anymore. Because you have to go, well, which open source funding partnership company do I use? It's like trying to find a hotel where you Google for hotels near where I am, and you get a million different appalling hotel websites.
That's just the nature of competition. That's how things get better.
I think there's a con, right? In this case, it's a pro for GitHub that they already have your billing information and they're already part of the process, so it decreases that friction. On the other side of that coin, though, is for open source projects that aren't on GitHub, what do they do? So in that regard, a third-party ecosystem may be better. So there's pros and cons to both sides of that, I think.
There are.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. The thing that I think is good is that I'm glad that this is something that people are focusing on, as we all think this is important. And like Jeremy said, there are benefits and disadvantages to all of these different approaches. The thing that I don't think many of these implementations are focusing on enough is the impact, the psychological, social impact of money on a traditionally non-financial project, right? Now, it's different for projects like Kubernetes, where you've got large commercial stakeholders who are feeding into it. That's fine. And this is where I think the Linux Foundation do a really good job in terms of setting up, you know, the governance around that kind of stuff. I think they generally do a pretty good job. But when you start applying that to, you know, something like Measure OSS, you know, where that Jeremy and Alan and a few other people and Stack are working on, it's a very different dynamic, because, you know, it's not like that's a commercially driven project.
That, I think, is exactly the vibe. There's a big yawning gulf between projects which are too small to need a whole bunch of governance and documents and complicatedness and hassle. And then you've got projects which are big enough to need that. It doesn't necessarily need to be ones with a large corporate sponsor. Things like the Apache project or Django or something like that is big enough that it needs all of that process and all of that governance and all of that documentation. But it's the same thing as just doing commercial deals, nothing to do with software, right? If you're setting up some kind of big exchange of money with someone, then you'll draw up a contract first, and there might be an NDA, and you'll work out payment terms and all this. But if I'm just bunging you a fiver to walk down to the shop and buy me a pie, I'm not going to make you sign an NDA and sign a contract first. And there's this kind of uneasy balance of how big do you have to be before you suddenly have to get into all of that sort of thing, which is hassle, undeniably.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it's interesting, and I think this is a good start. And I think all of these are going to evolve. You know, like I said earlier on, I would have, if I was GitHub, I would have focused on the project as opposed to the individual. But I also get why they did that, and I think it's a good first step.
Yeah. Any move in any direction at this point is probably a good thing,
right? Yeah. So, yeah. So, folks, if you want to go and donate to Jacosha,
and then
maybe Jeremy
on?
Can record decent audio.
Is Jacosha on GitHub?
I've no idea. I doubt it.
I assume not.
Way to ruin the joke, pal. Way to ruin the joke.
Yeah. There's a blast from the boss. Well, no, it'll be right up there next to Jack Field and KNet Stat or whatever it was called. What was your thing?
K-Webster. Yeah. Yeah, it's in the mausoleum of my dead code.
you should put it on GitHub. It'd be like Jordan Mechner releasing the source code for Prince of Persia on the Apple II.
Little different.
Well, that's not fair. One was a classic genre redefining piece of computer art, and the other one was Prince of Persia. So what's the next piece of news?
Well, do you want to talk about Stadia?
Sure.
We could.
The Google video gaming service.
Yes. First of all, isn't it Stadia?
Is it? I don't know. It sounds like a shitty hatchback from the 80s.
It does, actually. That is actually, I hadn't thought of that before you said that, but now you've made that point, I literally can't.
The Nissan Stadium.
Genuinely actually pretty funny.
I'm never going to be able to think of it not being that again. That's really irritating. Thank you for that.
So in a nutshell, we've seen some of these things before, right? It's a gaming service that essentially that streams over the internet.
Yep.
Runs in your browser. I remember years ago, Sony came out with a PlayStation, I think it's called PlayStation Now, is what it was called, which was a very similar kind of thing. And you download a client. Do you remember that German guy who worked in Ubuntu, the very German, with the glasses, Stefan something, I can't remember his name. He used to work on that Sony thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they launched Stadia recently, and it's not tremendously expensive from what I understand, and it basically runs in any Chrome browser. Is that right?
So what it is, and yes. They're calling this the Founders Edition if you buy it right now. It's $129. Right. You get 3 months of the service for free. You get some kind of Founders badge that you can only get on your account. You get the ability to give someone else 3 months for free. And you get the controller and a Chromecast Pro to stream it to a TV. What the actual service is, they recommend, and this I imagine outside of some areas is going to be an issue, is a minimum of a 10 meg connection. And if you want to go with some of the quicker speeds, it's substantially more from there.
Yes.
And so basically what they're saying is there's no downloads, everything, the game just starts. So if you have a 10 meg connection, you'll get roughly 720p. I think you need over 35 meg to get 4K. So many people will not get the best experience out of that. And then from there, it's going to be $10 a month. and that will get you a 4K experience, a better sound, and then the ability to access some library of games that are free and some other specific things. They also plan to, not at launch, but eventually have a free tier that's only either 720 or 1080p, limits you to stereo, no surround sound, and you get no games for free.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and they,
how much?
I forget the name of what they call the idea of being able to just rock up and buy individual games rather than buy the subscription service, but they have a specific marketing name for that.
Right. So if I understand correctly, you pay for the subscription service and then you get a ton of these games. You can basically play any of these games, right?
It's Netflix for games.
It's not, because Netflix, you cannot purchase additional content. With this, many of the games you buy, you just get the smaller free library for free with the subscription. You do not get all the games.
Netflix doesn't have premium stuff? I thought it did. Nope. Then it's Amazon Prime for games.
Yes, it is Amazon Prime for games.
Oh, I honestly haven't really looked into this. I was under the impression that you had a huge library like Netflix, as opposed to this is just a new platform, and then you can go and buy games, right?
It's a combination of the two. So there are some games which will be free. You don't pay your $9.99 a month for the privilege of being able to play games over the internet, and then you have to go and buy them anyway. There are some free games, and it's not clear whether a game that you might purchase on Stadia might be cheaper on Stadia than it is if you just walk into a shop and buy it, or buy it by download from the PlayStation Store or whatever, or the, you know, the, not the PlayStation Store, but Steam or the Epic Store. So,
right,
a lot of that stuff isn't wholly worked out yet, or if it is worked out, as far as I can tell, it's not been announced yet. So exactly how the pricing and so on will work is not clear. What I think's interesting is, you can talk about it being Spotify for games or Netflix for games, Amazon Prime for games, exactly, whatever. But people seem to have a different opinion on whether this is okay than whether Netflix is okay. And I found it interesting. There are certainly a bunch of people who are pushing back on the whole idea of gaming moving to subscription stuff, in the sense that they don't like the idea that if you stop paying, suddenly you lose access to all of your games, right?
So you and don't, games though,
have games have replay this. Value and so on and so forth. What do you mean?
But you don't lose. So if you stop paying and you've purchased a game, it's still playable with the free account. They've been pretty clear on that.
Right, yeah, okay. But the subscription model, if Google shut down Stadia, it's gone. If Stadia's down one evening, so you don't get to play.
This is where I think Google is in a difficult position, in that they've, I think, proven they're willing to, if something is not profitable, or sometimes it seems to be like with Reader, I don't know that it was even profitability. I think the VP left and it didn't have a new champion within the org, so just got killed. They've done that with enough things that I'm not a gamer, so this doesn't really apply to me, but I'd be very reticent if I were to get into this ecosystem, because outside of search, maybe Gmail and a couple of GCP, almost anything seems to be fair game to get shut down at Google, and that's given that this is definitely not guaranteed to succeed. The thing about succeeding at Google is it has to be a pretty large amount of money to move the needle, because they're such a large company. So success for them is different than success for many other companies, most other companies. So whether it will reach that bar, I don't think that's a guarantee.
I think the there are people worried about the subscription model as a whole, as a concept. And then on top of that, you've got Google and the people who are providing it, who are known to kill projects off. It's fascinating. I was at Foss Talk Live at the weekend just now, and Popey and I had a big, long discussion about the idea of a subscription service for games and how that was different to a subscription service for films and television, or a subscription service for music, for example. And there seems to be, in people's heads, a fundamental difference, which I personally don't see, but I'm beginning to believe that I'm a bit unusual in this, because I don't particularly like the idea of moving my music collection or getting rid of my music collection and just using Spotify. Right?
Well, you don't have to get rid of your music collection. You can just
no, right, but you know what I mean. The
do you not subscribe to a music service?
No.
Oh well. Do you, Jono?
Do I what?
Subscribe to any music service?
Oh. I live in Spotify. Okay.
So this is what I mean. So so the music industry has relatively successfully moved people onto a model where music is streamed to you from a service. If that service goes away, well, then you never own that music in the first place. Gaming right. is looking like it's going in the same direction. TV is going largely that direction. Who the hell, when was the last time you bought a DVD, right? But yep. It's
licensing. You're licensing content.
Yeah, obviously people selling you this stuff want this because it's recurring revenue. It's not one-time only revenue. And
right.
that's a good thing for them. I think it's interesting. Leaving aside the idea of whether Google Stadia is the best possible implementation of this concept, is it conceptually okay in the first place? And then even if you think it is, then you start thinking to yourself, do I want Google to be the people providing this?
I mean, hasn't Steam proved that it's fine if done well? I mean, also not a gamer, but isn't like...
I don't think this is... when you say people are concerned about this, I don't know who these people are. This to me seems like... This seems to me like this is a readily accepted... model that, increasingly businesses are using SaaS services such as Gmail and Salesforce and various other things to run their businesses. And if you don't pay your subscription, then you can download your data, but you lose access to that content. People buy their books using a Kindle. Steam works with the gaming side of things. Spotify does this with music. I don't know why this is controversial. Like this is logical.
I don't know if it's controversial. I think it doesn't meld well with some people's worldview, which is fair.
Right. Most recent person I saw complaining about this was about an hour ago, and that was Tycho from Penny Arcade, who is really well regarded in the gaming world. And
I'm not denying that people are disagreeing with it. I just don't get it because this is just the world that we're living in.
A moment ago, you did in fact deny that there were such people.
No, I didn't. No, what I meant to say was, look, people will complain about everything, right? So I'm not for a second suggesting there aren't people out there saying that this isn't what they want. What I'm saying is, I don't understand why someone would have that perspective because this is, I don't understand why. I understand why people would not want to use Stadia because they would prefer to go out and buy a game from Target in a box and have it on their computer and they own it and they can't have that game taken away from them. I get that. What I'm saying is people who are saying that this doesn't make sense as a business model, it does because this is how increasingly technology is being delivered to people. So I get why people don't want it for themselves, but people who are questioning the model of this, I don't understand why anyone would have that viewpoint.
Oh, okay, so slight distinction there, then I may not have explained it right. I haven't seen that many people going, I don't think this will work. I think the pitch tends to be, yeah, it'll probably work, but I'm not necessarily sure it's a good thing for gaming as a whole to go in this direction. Whether Spotify has been a good thing for the music industry seems to depend quite a lot on who you ask.
No. Spotify has been an awful thing for the music industry, and it's been consistently stated by artists that...
Well, that's exactly my point. Artists, and especially indie artists, hate it, because instead of selling a CD to someone, now they get 0.00004 cents at the end of the year or whatever. And... the gaming industry also has an awful lot of indies involved, and that's problematic, right? I believe Jono has frozen.
It does look like he's frozen. So I think the difference a little bit there, difference between Spotify is this, unless you're still buying games... So you could still, to my understanding, as an independent, you could still just sell your game on the platform. So I think part of the economics behind the all-you-can-eat model is that it's difficult to monetize in the way that selling a CD was for smaller for smaller artists before. So a little bit different, I think, in that regard. I think it's, to me, in my reading of this, it's more akin to, as opposed to having a console that you buy for $400 up front, you're forgoing that for a cloud service that you pay $10 a month to for perpetuity and hope that it stays up. And then from there, the game, it looks like for that money, you do get some free games, but the AAA games that gamers are going to want to buy, you still will just buy.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, essentially. It's going to come down to exactly how that model works. And I think a lot of the people who are pushing back on this and saying, I think subscription models are bad conceptually for gaming as a whole, because check out Spotify, are tilting the seesaw a bit too far in the, oh no, it's terrible, don't make it happen thing. But equally, people going, this is brilliant, it's so good, are guilty of the same thing in the other direction. It's gonna be a big, it's gonna make a big difference whether it ends up being Spotify or ends up being Netflix. Right, okay, so enough about Stadia. Next piece of news.
Yes.
Oh, so the next one in the dock is the single sign. Well, I guess it's actually not really single sign-on. The login with Apple, which is a little bit different than most single sign-ons. And Ak, you're probably best positioned to give the implementation details here.
Okay, so sign-in with Apple is Apple's new, we can call it single sign-on, I suppose, in the same way that sign-in with Facebook works or sign-in with Google works or whatever. But what's interesting about it is that if some company implements sign-in with Apple, so you can sign into their service using Apple's SSO, that company gets essentially a little unique set of data about you, which isn't your actual data. So if I build an app and I use sign-in with Apple, so you can sign into it, I have to build my own sign-in system. What I will get as the app owner is an email address which will get to you, but it's not actually your email address. I will get data about you, which is not actually your personal data. So I've got enough uniqueness that I can actually use this stuff, but it's not actually about you. It's not compromising your actual data. It's quite an interesting kind of vibe.
So disposable anonymous email forwarding is obviously a massive step forward for privacy. And
yes.
I think most tech-savvy people are already using Mailinator or one of the similar ones. I am, I guess, not clear how that doesn't break the SSO model completely.
Because Apple will still have all your personal information. They just won't give it out to people who are using sign-in with Apple. So you are still in a position of having to trust Apple. It's Google could do this tomorrow with signing with Google if they wanted to, right? At the moment, Google have all your information and they just hand it through to the previous people or to the people using it, right?
So, but I mean, I think most people consider SSO auth and identity, and this is just auth. They basically decoupled identity from auth completely.
Yes, but I don't think that there were that many people out there who are thinking, wow, if I sign in with Facebook on site A and I sign in with Facebook on site B, it is great that site A and site B know that I'm the same person on each.
I don't know if people think it's great. I think security conscious people don't think it's great. I also think security conscious people aren't using Facebook login for anything.
Yeah, but I think the
average consumer that uses those kind of things, I think they're conceptually, they understand when they log into a new site, it just knows who they are.
Yeah, but that I think is precisely the point. It's nobody's calling out for people to be able to link them across different sites. No one's particularly calling out against it unless they're security privacy conscious already. But no one's calling out for it. So breaking that won't change anything apart from the fact that these companies won't be able to quietly link you up behind the scenes. Right, which is why I think it's not a bad idea.
From a privacy perspective, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like about it is Apple are mandating that if you are an app on one of their platforms and you offer any single sign-on, so sign in with Google, sign in with Facebook, anything like that, you have to offer sign in with Apple as well.
At a time when Facebook and Apple and Google and Amazon are all facing monopoly scrutiny of some sort, that seems like a bold, bold move.
Well, this was actually my thought. It's I do not like this because they get to do that because they've got a wildly successful platform and I can't do that. That's the definition of what a monopoly is.
Yeah. So antitrust regulators putting big tech under the microscope everywhere you look, and you have Apple doing this.
Yeah, I think, obviously...
Are they really? But are they Are they really assessing all of these companies? I know that Google is under really significant scrutiny, right?
So Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Google are the four that I've seen with recent inquiries.
Oh, really? I didn't know about the other ones. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not surprised, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is... Obviously, if they just created Sign In with Apple and said, go ahead and use it if you want to, then basically nobody would, because why would they bother? But to give you an example, every single dating application uses Sign In with Facebook, right? So now they're all going to start offering Sign In with Apple as well. Bosh. There you go. You've got a third of the people on the platform. Like that. Click.
Yeah,
this is as far as I can tell, textbook abuse of monopoly power over who gets to publish stuff on your platform.
It does. It certainly seems that way.
What is the worst decision? That decision or the fact that they're selling a monitor stand for $1,000?
Oh my god!
Oh, that's not news.
They got raked over the coals on social media about that stand.
They did. I mean, even people I know who are abject Apple fans, not particularly tech people, but designers, architects, people like that, are kind of, this is just ridiculous. It feels almost contemptuous, you know.
It's, you know what it reminds me of, and I'm gonna have a bit of a minor rant that is related to this, is one thing that really grinds my gears is luxury brands that think that it's okay to take the piss when it comes to charging their customers. I'll give you an example of this. Erica and I both ended up staying in two different Ritz-Carlton hotels. One was at the Open Source Leadership Summit in Half Moon Bay that Jeremy was at as well, where I was brutally sick for it and missed pretty much the entire event. And then the second one was a conference Erica and I both went to in Hawaii. So we ended up staying at these Ritz-Carltons. And, you know, it's a pretty fancy brand, is Ritz-Carlton. And what blew me away was when I was sick at the Open Source Leadership Summit, I was in my bedroom for basically 3 days, feeling miserable for myself and only eating room service, right? And they charge a bloody fortune for everything. Certainly for room service. And then when we were in Hawaii, you know, they'll charge $15 for a smoothie and they'll charge $8 for a bottle of water. And it's like, what's ironic to me about this is that I think a lot of wealthy people are really pretty cost conscious, right? They know a lot about where their money's going. And that's one of the reasons why they've made a lot of money, is because they're financially responsible in many ways. And then, so I think a lot of wealthy people are quite happy to spend a lot of money on something they care about, which is why people go out to expensive dinners and stuff like that. But if you start charging a lot of money for something that isn't worth it, they think it's taking the piss. And I think the Ritz-Carlton are a good example of that through and through. There are other hotels that are luxury brand hotels. I'd say the Four Seasons are an example of this, where they don't do it quite so much. And to me, this Apple stand is a good example of that. People have always been happy to pay a lot more money for Apple gear because they feel like they're getting a much higher build quality and a really elegant kind of experience. But to charge $1,000 for a stand takes the piss out of their customers. And I think that's what people object to, is that, like, it's just ridiculous. I think it's insulting, you know? So, it bothers me in great depth.
I'm more bothered about the signing with Apple thing because I don't know what I think about it. I don't like the fact that they're going to push it on everyone and they are the only people in a position to do so, and that's not fair. But equally, if you... Jono, your point about competition earlier is, as far as I can tell, bullshit. Right?
What do you mean?
If I tried to build a better hotel website than everybody else, or a better single sign-on than everyone else, I wouldn't get anywhere. Because entrenched advantage is such a big differentiator that building a better mousetrap is not actually useful anymore. So if someone's going to, if you are the sort of person who believes that we should break the power of Google and Facebook to control identity on the internet, then something like signing with Apple is basically the only way it's going to happen. Whether I think it's therefore fair to do stuff I disagree with in service of a good end is what I don't know the answer to. And I have been somewhat conflicted over this in my head.
Well, I mean, we were talking about competition within the context of the sponsors thing, right? And I think that that's fine. I think we should, the way in which we get better technology in many cases and we get better things is by having a marketplace where people can compete. But I think to your point, Ak, if you've got giant companies that are basically rigging the game,
yeah.
So they're much better off to succeed than others. Then that's unfair, and that's the reason why you need to have, to a degree, the government looking in. I mean, it's exactly the same thing with Internet Explorer, right?
Yeah.
Back in the early days,
you need,
and I get that,
antitrust laws with teeth. We have antitrust laws, whether they've got teeth, still undecided.
And it's more complicated now than ever, given the fact that everything is so networked and that every product now seems to depend on another API. You know, like so many products are just like the integration with other things is so critical, right? So you get this really complicated web of things. So naturally people are wanting to bias things towards their own products, but I don't know.
Totally, you know, it's a big question, one of the big questions for how we're going to proceed technologically in the next 10 or 15 years, and I don't know the answer to it. Anyway, we've drifted slightly further afield from signing with Apple than we might have wanted to. But is there anything else you wanted to mention?
We never do that on Bad Voltage, do we?
No, it is weird.
We never drift. No, I think we're about out of time. Certainly for me, because I've got to go and do something. But
that's cool.
I
will mention that as I said, I was at Vostok Live this weekend just past, and a bunch of people.
How was it?
It was really cool. Actually, it was a really good evening. Well done, well done, Joe Reston, for setting it up and running it and everything. And it was good laugh to hang out with everyone. But I had a bunch of people come up and say how much they enjoyed Bad Voltage. Mostly me, not so much you two, but. But
oh, that's cool to hear.
But seriously, folks. But yes, people really do seem to enjoy the show, and I said I would pass that on.
Nice. Well, thank you. Yeah.
Much
well, we certainly enjoy the show.
Yeah.
So if we enjoy it and you folks enjoy it, then it's a win-win situation. So
exactly the theory. Are you guys doing anything interesting in the next couple of weeks?
Hopefully not.
Nothing in the next couple of weeks for here.
Excellent. No. I think the next thing I'm going to is going to be the Open Source Summit, which is going to be in San Diego in August. But other than that, we just got a new dog,
nice,
which is exciting.
McBiscuit.
And yeah, well, interestingly, got back from being on holiday on Saturday night after 24 solid hours of traveling, and also American Airlines suck to great lengths, by the way, just so we're all clear on that. Picked up a new puppy on Sunday morning, so he was eating everything, including our son. And then on Monday morning, Erica started a COO at GitHub. So it's been quite the couple of days since we got back. And all of this, we've been jet lagged. So.
It's been a quiet week, is what you're saying.
Yeah, which is why I don't want any more excitement. I just want to sit here with my pipe and slippers and complain about the young kids. So
I can understand that entirely. All I did was eat an unlimited fry up on Sunday morning. It's...
Excellent. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. And as usual, go to community.badvoltage.org. Let us know what you think. Or go to the Slack channel. Let us know what you think. And we'll see you next time.